My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Adam.
I want to first thank you for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to the people that are new. You know, if you're trying AA one more time tonight, if you don't want to be here, if you don't think this will work for you, I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us eventually, like we just read, it became a matter of life and death. I think that every group has their perpetual newcomer. I'm sure that, you know, in a smaller area, you see that guy, the perpetual chip taker. And that was me. I mean, I had so many chips and key tags in AA. I could have played poker with them. It was horrible. I remember one secretary saying, "Give them back." You know, and I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And, you know, what I would do as a newcomer is I would go into your head and I would look back at myself and I would think, gosh, what a loser. Why can't you get this? What's wrong with you? And I know the old timers were judging me. You know, if you're new, we're judging. I mean, I love it when they say, oh, don't judge anybody in AA. You guys ever hear that? And then what do they tell you 5 minutes later? Stick with the winners. I mean, that's not confusing, right? I can remember sitting in my counselor's office. I'm sitting in this detox in treatment across this big table. And he looks at me and he says, "Now, Adam, don't make any major changes in your first year." So I come to AA, get a sponsor. What's the first thing he tells me? "You got to change everything." Right? I mean, don't make any major decisions in your first year. Anybody seen the third step? Right? How about don't get in a relationship in your first year? No one knows if that works. No one's ever done it. I always look for the people that aren't laughing. Right? There's always a saint in the crowd. If you got a halo, don't let it choke you. But the one I love is God doesn't give us more than we could handle. If I really believe that, if God didn't give me more than I could handle, I wouldn't need God's help. And the longer I've been sober, the longer I've been separated from alcohol, the more I've come to terms very slowly with the fact that I desperately need God's help. I need your help. And if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me what I could never do for myself. It's done for us collectively as a group and as a fellowship and as a society what many of us could never do. And I think that if I live to be 100 years old, I could never pay Alcoholics Anonymous back for the kindness and for the love. And looking back at that experience, the shame of being new and doing that walk of shame, I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers, a lot of the old-timers that aren't with us anymore. That said stuff to me like, "You know what? Don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up." In a loving way, right? But they also made it very clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it very clear to me that if and when, because they knew it wasn't right now, but if and when I was ready, that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think looking back at that experience now, next to my parents, Alcoholics Anonymous is the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like me will ever experience. No matter how many lives I destroyed, how many promises I broke, how many cars I wrecked, how many jobs I lost, how many despicable, shameful things. And if you're an alcoholic like I am, it's shameful to watch the people that love you destroy your life. To watch the people that sent me to school, that had all those dreams and hopes for me. To watch them watch me burn my life to the ground. But despite all of that, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous have always been open to people like me. And I will be forever grateful, and so will my family for that. So, you know, with all this gratitude, eventually I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about AA these days, 2016, if you see a guy drunk in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting these days, people say stuff like, "Oh my gosh, what's he doing here?" I mean, that's not irony, right? And no disrespect to the therapeutic community, but that has a lot to do with treatment, which is now a $35 billion industry that's kind of grown up about AA, you know, that swoops us up in our most desperate moments, throws us into yoga class. Right? Craft hour. I'm making like belt buckles and bongs. Nature walks. You know, what I do is I'd go to 7-Eleven, I'd better get a big gulp cup, I'd fill it up with liquor. I live in L.A., they sell liquor at 7-Eleven in L.A. And, you know, I'd fill it up with liquor, and I'd cruise into the late-night Hollywood candlelight meeting. You know, do some of my best sharing. Now, I know there's a lot of young people here, and I just want you to know that I was 16, 17, 18 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, 25, 30 years ago, there were not a lot of young people in AA. And at that time, you know, the old-timers said stuff like, you know what, kid, we spilled more than you drank. And we were like, you know what, Pops, we didn't spill any. That's why we got here sooner. We have a chapter in the big book, The Chapter to Wise, and I'd never read The Chapter to Wise up until a point in my recovery. But if you read that chapter, The Chapter to Wise talks about four specific types of alcoholics. It enumerates them, type 1, type 2, type 3. And the fourth type of alcoholic in The Chapter to Wise is described as an alcoholic that drinks on his way home from the hospital, that's been placed in one institution after another. Sound familiar? And in those 17 years that I took ships over and over again, that is what I'd become. By the time I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times. I know, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times, and I wore that like a badge of honor. I thought that's what made me an alcoholic, and I remember telling my sponsor, you know, hey, I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would get rid of the guy, you know, loser. Ruin his batting average, right? Go find someone that's willing. And he looks me right in the eye, and he says, you know, Adam, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, no, it means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny either. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says, any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run, but in and of itself, treatment never solved the problem. And like so many of us, I always thought the problem was alcohol. I'd been hearing that since I was in the 8th, 9th grade. Why do you drink so much? Why don't you just stop? Why are you always loaded in class? That's what we call frothy emotional appeal. It seldom suffices. And I always thought the problem was alcohol. And I remember someone in AA saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then in the very next breath, he says to me, and if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is an alcohol. And I'm like, what? It took me another decade to understand what he was trying to tell me. It was like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But when I got around a home group that was dedicated to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that turned the statements in the book into questions. Was I incapable of being honest? Did I drink because I liked the effect? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent? Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking? As those statements were turned into questions and directed at me, for the first time in my life, I started to see the truth about alcoholism. And one of those truths I saw is that even as a teenager, I was never able to live with alcohol. Even in 8th, 9th, 10th grade, I was already pissing in my pants. I was already drooling on my desk. I was already passed out under the bleachers. My nickname in 8th grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People are picking high schools, I'm picking rehabs, right? See, everyone could see I couldn't live with alcohol. But alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or 12-packs. Or shot glasses. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson calls it, centering in my mind, if it shows me anything at all, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, this type, cannot live without alcohol. Not successfully, not happily. And if I really look at what it means for me to be an alcoholic, what I see in part is that it means that I have a mind that will continue to take me back to booze. Over any considerable period of time, what it means for me to be an alcoholic is I seem to have this mind that eventually leads me back to drinking. It's almost like my default mode, like on a computer. And it's interesting because I was sponsoring a computer programmer and he was very quick. And he said to me, he said, you know, Adam, in 1939, if you listen to the language that Bill Wilson used in 1939, because we use these words like program. He said that one of the definitions of a program relating to computers is a sequential set of instructions that brings about a result. And then he said, you know what you do when you get a corrupt file in a computer? Listen to the language. You put in a recovery disk. And what does it do? Oh, it restores it to an earlier point in the process. Then he tells me that steps 10 and 11 are like the viral scan. And it took me a long time to understand what he was saying. And I don't mean to be disrespectful to the fellowship. But for 17 years, I had confused the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with the program. And although they seem like they're the same thing, they don't always occur in the same place. See, the fellowship gives me enthusiasm, it gives me inspiration, it gives me encouragement, right? It gives me hope, sympathy, brotherly love. Some people get relationships and employment here. But for me as an alcoholic, until I went through the big book and took some very specific, deliberate actions. Now, this may not be true for everybody, but for me, I got sicker in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became more separate, more different, and more alone. Separated from God, different from every single one of you, and alone. The fellowship was critical to welcome me. I saw the kindness, all the people that welcome me today. You know, they ask you to dress. They say, you know, you don't have to dress up, but you are representing AA, right? And then when you show up, everyone says, oh, you must be the speaker. But all the love and the kindness and the friendship is what brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. It got me here. But when I start to look at the very simple, specific actions that keep me here, it becomes much different. And, you know, I look back now at my failure, 17 years of failure in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I see in my life is my defiance towards spiritual principles. In the original manuscript, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions. Right now, if you're like me, I don't like directions. I don't like being told not to do something I already don't want to do, right? I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. And then I'll blame you for eternity. Sound familiar? That's why we say denial's an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You could tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell him much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that means is you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And when we talk about how critical the traditions are, how important attraction rather than promotion is, I start to understand what that means is for me as an alcoholic, I had to get to AA on my own terms. Not because of the judicial system, not because my mommy wanted me to, not for the parole office, but because I'd burned my life to the ground. And looking back at that experience now, I know that for me, hope doesn't matter to someone like me until I become hopeless. Just like this idea of God is not going to matter to me. Until I really see that self-reliance has failed me. So what happened to me is I got to one more treatment center. I was 120 pounds. If you're new, by the way, thank God we don't look like our stories, right? So I'm in this treatment center, about your weight, 120 pounds. You know, I look like I just got out of a concentration camp. My fingers are dirty. I stink like urine. And I'm in this nightgown, right, in detox. Thinking I got it going on. Right? Judging the speaker. I mean, we're the only people that can actually be on the curb and look down at the world, right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. And I'm strutting around the detox, bragging about Robin Brink's trucks. I do my four-step. It was a bread truck. And it was empty. Sound familiar? So I'm sitting in the detox with my fellow associates, and this woman from AA comes in on her H&I panel. If you're new, as we passed this basket earlier for H&I, H&I stands for Hospitals and Institutions. It's a committee that brings meetings into prisons, detoxes, treatment centers, hospitals, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get to meetings. Our H&I on the west side of L.A., it's about 250 people, and they're fighting each other to get on these panels to talk to people that don't really care. So there I am. I'm in the detox. This woman is doing her AA talk, and at the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down, and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her and I looked at the guy next to me and I said, what a bitch. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And if you're new, that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender that each and every one of us, remember, if you're new, every single one of us has had to walk that journey. And as a newcomer, I could write about step one all day long until I'd beaten down that liquor store door at 5:59 a.m. over and over and over, or paid the clerk at 7-Eleven $100 for a six-pack, or driven all the way. That's why I had no problem driving down here. I've driven all the way to the border to get a drink many times. But until I'd done all those despicable, diabolical, disgusting things that many of us do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you think writing about step one was going to help me? I had to have a relationship with alcohol. And I got to a place, you know, because that gift of desperation, it's a great acronym for God, right? But for many of us, I got to a place in my life where my head couldn't get enough, and my body couldn't take any more. Remember what that looks like when you're knocking on death's door? Then I start to understand what it means to drink against my will. It's interesting because when my head can't get enough and my body can't take any more, you know, God means something totally different. It means grow or die. Then I got two choices. And we know what they are, right? One is go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. What's the other one? Oh, accept spiritual help. And they intimate that those are really not easy choices. Now, if you're young, you know, when I was a teenager, it was like life was like a game show. I had all these opportunities, all these options, marriage, education, military, career, right? Final stages of alcoholism, there's two doors left. Go on to the bitter end, accept spiritual help. Now, it's very interesting because if you were to do a survey at Walmart, well, maybe not Walmart, how about Costco, right? You never know what you're going to get at Walmart, but jails, institutions of death, happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer, right? You ask me that same question and I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic death? Can I talk to my public defender and my counselor and I'll get back to you? And what I start to see, like we were talking about earlier, is I cannot differentiate the true from the false. My alcoholic life becomes my only normal one. And that becomes something that I really have to see. I have to see that, you know, I remember my sponsor said, he said, Adam, I want you to buy a black suit. And I said, why? And he said, well, if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous, unfortunately, you're going to go to a lot of funerals. And he got really serious. And then he smiled and he said, oh, and by the way, if you drink again, at least we'll have something nice to bury you in. And what I've come to understand is if you baby the alcoholic, you'll bury him. I need to hear the truth about alcoholism, that it is fatal, it is progressive, it is chronic. We talk about jails, institutions of death. It's like hamburgers, fries, and a Coke. But see, I live in a world of delusion. It's very interesting because think about this. If you throw a guy a life raft and he looks at the life raft and he says, well, I was looking for a blue one. Or maybe I don't like the way you threw it. You know if you're a sponsor, it's going to be a hard road, right? But alcohol beat me into a state of reasonableness. And if you're new, again, we're the only people that actually want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. I mean, welcome to AA. I mean, if you're feeling heroic because you gave up your big Saturday night to hang out with us, this is the only place on God's earth where they'll applaud because you came in to save your own life. I mean, if you're sitting here tonight thinking about drinking, that beats the hell out of being in some sleazy bar thinking about getting sober, right? I mean, come on. You're wondering when the miracle's going to happen? You're in AA on a Saturday night. It's happened. Welcome. And I know this is kind of a weird thing to say. I was told that my recovery and my sobriety is God's gift to me. Eventually, I had to ask the question what my gift back would be. There's three prayers in this life. One is God help me. Remember we all said it? God help me. What's the second prayer? God give me. The greatest distraction on earth. But the prayer I'd never said was God use me. And I end up down here. And I could never, ever pay Alcoholics Anonymous back. I am so grateful to all the men and women that helped me, the good and the bad. You know, and that was something that really, really resonated with me, is the kindness that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I mean, I do a lot of H&I. I should, right? I'm an alumni from everywhere. And one of the greatest examples of surrender I'd ever heard came out of one of those panels. I've been doing panels at the VA up in West LA for years. And, you know, we get into a room this size full of soldiers. It's a really big institution up there. And room full of soldiers. And they ask us, you know, as a panel to pick a topic. And I'm a smart aleck, so I pick surrender. Room gets dead quiet. Especially Marines. But if you're new, you might want to look at this relationship between surrender. You ever watch a soldier surrender, like on CNN in a theater of combat? The illustration's perfect. You'll see the soldier take the rifle, very slowly lay it on the ground, sit down on the side of the road, wait for someone to tell him what to do. Think about it. When you got 40 AK-47s pointed at your head, you don't throw down the gun with an attitude. No offense to the court cards. You're not sitting on the side of the road looking back at the gun, right? Because if you do, someone's going to shoot you. And I have to ask myself, am I looking back at alcohol? Because that's what it was for me. It was like I was in the high school gym 20 years later. The band was gone, the girls were gone, the lights were out, and I'm in this empty, dark room saying, where's the party? There's no disco ball where I was drinking. But see, that is the euphoric recall. That is the peculiar mental twist. That is the lurking reservation that Bill Wilson talks about. That idea that precedes that first drink will kill me. Life has its moments, and for those very moments as an alcoholic, I will give my life to recapture and recreate the magic that I once found in booze. And my experience continues to show me that unless I can find that sense of comfort and ease that I'm seeking from alcohol through this process, a drunk like me will never stay here. You take booze away from me, you got to give me something better. And that in my experience over a period of time is what completely changed my idea about Alcoholics Anonymous. That really the disease of alcoholism is the only disease when treated that actually leaves the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. And I could have never believed that until I got around a group of people that took me through this process. And again, like I say about delusion, I don't want to offend anybody. The therapeutic community has its rightful place in recovery. But, you know, going through treatment 28 times, I mean, I don't want to be offensive, but I started to speak a foreign language in treatment. You guys know what it is, right? It's called victimese. I don't understand how the drink bone connects to the jail bone. It's like, I need a class for that, right? It's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. Always someone going through that. I knew he was a crackhead. I can't believe he stole my iPhone. Met her at the strip club. Can't believe she cheated. No offense to the dancers. My friend said, it works if you twerk it, right? But what the book talks about is how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. If I do not connect those dots through inventory, I will continue to play victim. Guess what? Victims don't stay sober. And I lived every single one of those lies. And my sponsor, he talked about continuing to take inventory. And I'm trying to understand this process. And he says, it is very similar. This may be a peculiar analogy, but very similar to going to the ATM machine. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, you know, what do you do when you go to the ATM machine? You put in the card, you put in the code, you take your money, right? Put in the card, put in the code, take your money, put in the card, put in the code. And after a while, I'm like, I get it. I have this epiphany. I stop doing it. I understand the process. And he said, why would you stop doing it? Do you realize what's going on behind the wall? I said, no. He said, the account's being debited. See, normal people seem to be intellect over emotion. They think, they process, and they act, right? I'm exactly the opposite. I'm emotion over intellect. I act, process, and then think. Oops, 10th step. Oh, come on. We're the only people that burn bridges ahead of us. And if you're laughing, you're relating. That's not right. Normal people do not relate to that. So when it talks about a complete psychic change, a complete shift in perception, there is a point at which I start to process differently. I see how I make those decisions based on self. It talks about the problems are very much of my own making, although I don't think so. And I had to go through that fifth step process of admission, acknowledgement with another human being, and an eventual acceptance. And that was, in many ways, where change was born. They'd say, if you don't change your sobriety date, well, I 100% believe that now. But on my own terms, I was unable to change here. That's why I understand when we say, you know, God doesn't give us more than we can handle, how critical that was in step 6 and 7, that I asked for help again. And for me, you know, fear's not going to keep a guy like me sober. I don't know about you, but getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my big career, losing my family. Did Scared Straight work for you? Right? It went right over my head. Now, the big book talks about the problem drinker, right? It illustrates the problem drinker as someone that can stop or moderate given sufficient reason. Huge difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. Think about it. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a jail cell for, say, drunk driving. You get two completely different philosophies going on. You get the problem drinker over here on one side of this cell thinking, gosh, why'd I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Why didn't I take a taxi? Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, why'd I take the 805? Now watch, the court card people don't think that's funny at all. That is not funny. Right? You could have stayed on Surface Street. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Problem drinker's wife says, honey, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. Problem drinker cleans up his act, doesn't drink in the house, get the little Visine. Now, if my woman says, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you, you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. (Laughter) And eventually I will see that relationship transfer into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if anything got in the way of booze, it was out of my life. I mean, alcohol was the love of my life, right? It had me from hello. It completed me. Right? You think I'm going to let go of the love of my life without a fight? I can't even let go of a bad relationship. Everything I let go of has claw marks all over it. If you're new, my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous is identical. If anything gets in the way of AA for me, it's out of my life. A woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how much she loves me, how great it feels, how in love I am. I remember the first time I said that in an AA meeting, there she was in the back of the room. She's like, honey, you don't look like an alcoholic. Oh my goodness, why do you got to go to all those meetings? Every day? Oh please, you're not speaking again, it's the weekend. Then she tells me, you know that AA thing, it's getting in the way of our relationship. So a couple months later, it's the holiday season, we're still dating, it's the big night, it's meet the parents night, right? So she gets me all dressed up, suit and tie, head of the table. I'm at her parents' house. Out comes the exotic wine. She's like, honey. Oh, honey, you can have one glass of wine. Oh, it's just a glass of wine. Come on, we're going to have a little toast. The whole family's here. It's natural wine. Four more rehabs. I stole her purse that night. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue. Yeah. And she came to detox with a get well card. Poor girl. I think I got four cards from that one. No offense. I tried to send her to Codependents Anonymous. She wouldn't go. You know why? She didn't have anyone to go with. Now, no offense, I can always tell the Al-Anons in the crowd, they don't think any of this is funny. They can't stand to see us have a good time even here, right? I'll tell you, I come from a long line of alcoholism. My mother's brother committed suicide drunk. My father's brother committed suicide drunk. I come from alcoholism, suicide, and mental illness on both sides of my family. And I remember my mom moved and didn't leave a forwarding address. And in some ways, it was the perfect Al-Anon move. Because it forced me. It forced me to look at it. A friend of mine said, you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. The Al-Anon detaches and lets it screw itself. Al-Anon saved my life. It saved my life. Because I would come out of treatment and they're like, oh, what are you, better than us now because you don't drink? And I started to understand I didn't cause it, I didn't cure it, I can't control it. I learned how to mind my own business and have some business to mind. I learned that this fellowship would carry me through that. And I was the weakest link in my family. And what happened because of Alcoholics Anonymous is eventually I became the strongest link in that family. And they all came to me. And I got to reunite with my mother. I got to take her to doctors. I got to be the son that she had always wanted. All because of AA. And I'm so lucky because I've had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of people that didn't get that. You know, maybe their parents died in prison or they didn't get that opportunity. But I'm so grateful. And my family is so grateful. I mean, I sponsor people that pay more in taxes than I earn all year. They have these huge careers and these little tiny programs. I've never seen one of them stand the test of time here. What do I do for a living? I stay sober. Or what do I do for money? That's over there. I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in handcuffs. I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in an emergency room. Or I get a double header, I'm handcuffed to a gurney in an emergency room. But that has consistently been my experience. that anything I put in front of AA was taken from my life. And what I would do in Alcoholics Anonymous is I would build AA around my big life. I would get the job, the house, the girl, the car. And as my life expanded, you know what happens to AA? It becomes very inconvenient. And what I've had to do in order to stay here and truly thrive is I've had to build my life around Alcoholics Anonymous. And unless I really understand what the problem is, the solution's not going to work. And you hear it in chapter 5. Every time we read chapter 5, we talk about our personal adventures before and after, right? Make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that I'm an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And C, that God could and would have sought. And I'm thinking, before and after what? What are they talking about? But for me as an alcoholic, it's before and after I stop drinking. See, the problem drinker thinks the unmanageability in the second half of step one is because of drinking. If that's true, stop drinking. If alcohol is the problem, the solution is abstinence. If you're new, unless I really understand what the problem is, the solution's not going to work. And in the doctor's opinion, it says some of us are entirely normal except the effect produced by alcohol. But then it talks about another type that our first speaker alluded to. The type that's restless, irritable, and discontent by nature. Restless. What do we call it now? ADD, right? This irritability where I have this fault-finding mind. It's quick to anger, slow to forgive. And then on the other side of all of that, I got this discontentment that you were talking about, which means the shine wears off everything right away. Sound familiar? I get this brand new car I've been saving up all year. I don't even get it off the lot. It's the wrong color. Right? Get a new house. I'm not even out of escrow. I hate the neighbors. New job. More money than I've ever made. I'm doing the math. I'm getting ripped off. Sound familiar? Right? Get a new relationship. It's 90% great, 10% bad. I can't leave it alone. I'm already correcting her. So I start to see that I have something underneath this, a spiritual maladjustment. And unless I understand what the problem is, the solution is not going to work. And what the problem for me is when I stop drinking, before and after, when I stop drinking, the outsides get better, but the insides get worse. And the longest bridge that I will ever cross, the longest journey that I will ever walk, as a person in recovery, is that little tiny hyphen between the first and second half of step one. It's telling me I got a body that can't process alcohol, but more importantly, I have a mind that cannot process reality. Those are two independent concepts. And I thought for years, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. That's like looking at the tip of an iceberg and seeing the broken home, the ruined marriage, the failing health. Right? And thinking that's the problem. In fact, that's what treatment tells me the problem is. Treatment's telling me the trigger's on the outside, right? It's on the outside. And I'm sitting in class in my nightgown, learning about my triggers. And I'm like, counselor, waking up's a trigger for me. I'm awake. And what I eventually see through the 12-step process is for an alcoholic of my type, the trigger's on the inside. You ever notice when an alcoholic's not having a good day? You know when I'm not having a good day? When I'm not getting my way. Oh, come on. We're all like 5-year-old kids here with old people's faces. Oh, you don't believe it? Cross one of us. I'll resent you for decades. And your grandkids. Cancel my pass at rehab. I'm going to hang myself. Sound familiar? Harry Tebow says we're grandiose, immature, and sensitive. Those are my better qualities. So then I start to understand what this underlying problem is. It's my need to play God. My need to be right, right? My need to sort, compare, judge, and label. My need to remember everything I should forget and forget everything I should remember. The big book says I am driven by 100 forms of fear. And what I see when I'm not drinking is that I have a severe emotional overreaction to 5 things. Abandonment, rejection, betrayal, disrespect, and authority. And they all come out of the third column. They are defined for me in that third column. And they're all driven by fear. Fear of abandonment, right? That's the relationship one. Fear of betrayal. Fear of disrespect. More people get shot behind that one than all of them, right? Fear of authority. Fear of rejection. It's a million miles wide, it's a million miles high, but it's paper thin. And what I discovered going through this process is that what alcoholism is in many ways is me trying to solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution. And the three most important words going through inventory and working with people in AA were, yeah, me too. I felt like that too. And that was something, until I got close and started working with others, I didn't understand that all of these human failings are universal to all of us. The greatest gift that I ever got. You know, when I really look back at it, my sponsor said to me, he said, Adam, what do you want from AA? You recycled through the rooms for 17 years. And I said, well, I grear up in Malibu. I want a yacht and a Learjet. And you know what he said to me? He said, if you work steps 4 through 9 and you consistently live in 10, 11, and 12, what you'll get, because I'm a taker, I'm here to get something. He says, what you'll get is a quiet mind and a loving heart. And I looked at him and I thought, what do I want that for? He talks about the grouch and the brainstorm. You know what the opposite of a quiet mind is? You know, right? A mind that won't shut up. A mind that's up at 3 a.m. telling me I'm a loser. What's the opposite of a loving heart? It's a vindictive heart. It's a prejudiced heart. It's a resentful heart. And all of my life, I've been crucified between two thieves. Yesterday and tomorrow. And yesterday I have guilt, shame, and remorse. And tomorrow I have fear, anxiety, and worry. And just like that continuation of inventory, that analogy, what happens as I continue to go through this process of looking at my fear, looking at my resentment, looking at my future, looking at my past, is eventually I get a quiet mind. Our spirits are very much like a body of water. When they're perfectly still, they best reflect the heavens. I know how to get there with a bottle of liquor. But if you take booze away from someone like me and you don't give me something better, I will never stay here. Alcohol is classified by the AMA as a depressant. Most people have a couple drinks and they're like, I got to slow down. I'm feeling it. I have a couple drinks and I have two drinks and I'm like, honey, I want to get married. I want to go to Vegas. I'm trying to find the car keys I hid for myself before the first drink. And for me, alcohol is a stimulant. Alcohol does so much for me, I don't care what it's doing to me. And that's what the earth people don't understand about us. Or the Al-Anons. They can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why you don't. Now you know. In closing, if someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. And then I come to AA and you want me to pray to God? I didn't want God to find out where I was. That is a conscious separation from God. If you really look at these 12 steps by design, steps 1 through 3, recreate and develop a relationship with God. 4 through 7, recreate and develop a relationship with self. 8 and 9, recreate and develop a relationship with others. 10, maintains and develops my relationship with self. 11, maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with God. 12, through service, maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, a selfish, self-centered drunk like me is not only easily able to control my desire for alcohol, but for the first time in my life, I'm able to live in harmony with God, self, and others. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? What did he say? Love God with all thy heart. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And if God scares you out of AA and you're a real drunk, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. Very simple idea. We talk about a principle being a core belief which becomes the foundation of my life. And I hope that you might hear this if you're new. The idea, I would rather live my life pretending there's a God and finding out there isn't than live my life pretending there's no God and finding out there is one. That second step idea, to find the love, to see the camaraderie, to see the unity, is something that grew. In 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. So what happened to me when I got out of that 28th rehab is the guy that was running the detox said, Adam, why don't you come back to detox next week and tell everybody in the detox how you stayed sober a whole week? If you can make it. That was a resentment, right? So for the next 8 years, I sat in 3 hours of bumper-to-bumper L.A. traffic all the way from like LAX to the West Valley to tell a bunch of strangers in detox who didn't care how I made it a whole week. And I was tricked into service. There's a poem in Notre Dame. It says, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother, and I found all three. And when Bill Wilson met Dr. Bob, that same idea is something that we've been duplicating for almost 80 years. And treatment says, oh, there's no evidence-based results in AA. How do you get 100,000 people flying to Atlanta last summer to celebrate our anniversary? 100,000 on their own money. And you say there's no evidence-based results? Ask treatment to show us their results. Thank you.